In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And then God spoke. And God spoke over the next 6 days to systematically and orderly transform that formlessness into form, and that emptiness to be filled. We observed last time in our studies in this book of Genesis that God, in the first 3 days, formed the formlessness. He provided an appropriate environment for the living things that he would later make. And now in the second set of 3 days, God sets to work filling it. We have already noted the parallels between the first 3 days and the second 3 days. In day one, God said, "Let there be light." Without light, nothing can live. On day four, God said, "Let there be lights." On day one, he separated the light from the darkness and called the light day, and the darkness he called night. On day four, we're told that he set in this environment of light and darkness heavenly bodies which would rule over them. Literally, the Hebrew has the sense of dominate them. When we look out into the daylight, we cannot help but note the sun. Its warmth and its light give us life. At night time, it is the moon that dominates the sky. This greater light and lesser light, as they are described in verse 16. It's interesting to note that God doesn't actually use the Hebrew words for the sun and the moon. For by this time in the history of Israel, as Moses pens his account of creation and provides the nation of Israel with the background and context for their existence, and for their calling out of all the nations of the earth to be a special nation set apart for the purposes of God, at that time, the God of the sun and of the moon, whose names were almost identical to the Hebrew words, these were a dominant feature in the worship of the Egyptians, from whom the Israelites have so recently been released. And so he simply calls them the greater light and the lesser light, emphatically stating that it is the God who has revealed himself to Israel at Mount Sinai, the God who has spoken into their darkness, the God who has spoken his law into their lives, this God created the sun. This God created the moon. This God is indeed the God of gods and the Lord of lords. All powers are subject to him. What were the purposes then for these lights that were made? The light is already shining. 3 days have passed. And light by day and darkness by night has already been evident. Why then these particular lights? Well, he tells us that these lights are given to separate the day from the night, to be markers of the daytime and of the nighttime. They are set there as signs for the seasons, for the days, for the years, to allow mankind to keep a track of the seasons and of the passing of time. And then to be the providers of light during the daytime and during the nighttime. And so God made these two great lights, the greater to rule the day, the lesser to rule the night, and the stars, Moses seems to state almost as an afterthought. And God set them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth, to rule or to dominate the day and the night, and to separate the light from the darkness. The stars, this almost an afterthought in the mind of Moses as he records the creation. Some estimates put the number of stars at 10 times more than the grains of sands on all the seashores and in all the deserts of the world. We don't really think in those terms. When you go down to the beach and you see the grains of the sands, it's hard to imagine that there could be more stars than that. 70,000 million, million, million stars is an estimate. I can't picture that number. 70,000 I can cope with about the population of Palmerston North. But 70,000 million, 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 well, that's an awful lot of zeros. And they're just an afterthought. He made the great light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. And the stars. So great is this God who can speak these heavenly bodies into existence. And then what about this greater light to rule the day? I think it's Stephen Hawking who describes it as an average, an ordinary star. Well, it's certainly not ordinary, even if it may be average. It's actually quite a unique star, a special star. Most stars, we're told, are smaller, cooler, dimmer, and have less mass than the sun. That would have a big impact upon life on Earth. 1/2 to 2/3 of those 70,000 million, million, million stars have a companion star, and the sun does not. The light and heat from most stars is very variable, but the sun is relatively constant. And most sun-like stars, recognizing that there are a huge variety of different stars and types, most sun-like stars produce enormous superflares about once a century. But our sun doesn't. In other words, these features make it possible for life to exist on Earth. And what then of the moon, this lesser light to rule the night? And in case you're saying, well, the moon is no light, it doesn't give light in and of itself. The Hebrew word actually encompasses the idea of reflector as well as producer of light. This lesser light then that reflects the light of the sun to give some light, diminished light certainly, but some light during the night time and to dominate the light, the night, to rule over the night. What of this moon? Well, that too has specific purposes. It is an efficient reflector given its size. It is able to provide sufficient light to provide the necessary rule and domination that God prescribed. The moon also helps us to keep time in its regular orbit around the earth, providing its phases of new moon and first quarter and full moon and third quarter and so forth. It provides an efficient and regular timekeeper. But more than that, the moon actually has an effect upon this earth. Its mass provides the tides which enable the oxygen in the seas to circulate, provides nutrients, and generally keeps the oceans moving and keeps them clean. Well, there's much more that we could say about that, but sufficient to say that if these two lights in particular did not dominate the day and the night, there could be no life on this planet. This is a place designed by God for life to flourish. And while our sun may be described by some as an average star, an ordinary star, in the mind of God, it's a very specific star with a very specific purpose. For it is on this planet, out of all the many planets in our solar system and throughout this vast universe, it is this planet on which God has chosen to put life. It is on this planet that God chose to create man in his own image. That, of course, is for our consideration on another day. But we must not forget that all that is unfolding in these early verses of the book of Genesis has in the mind of God the things that will come later in the book of Genesis. And I don't simply mean up to the point where God created man and placed man in the Garden of Eden to govern it, to rule over the birds of the air and the fish of the sea and the creatures of the earth, and everything was very good. But everything that happens here in these early verses of Genesis have also in the mind of God the fall of man and what would take place after that. For that is no accident of history, but it was all in the mind of God before he ever set about this vast work of creation. And so, day one, God formed this environment of light and darkness. And in day four, God filled this environment with the heavenly bodies, focusing his attention on an ordinary star, so-called, and a lesser light, which would dominate the view from earth. In day two, God created the sky and the seas by separating this vast water over which his spirit had hovered in the midst of the darkness before he spoke light into existence. On day five, God filled the sky and the seas. God said, "Let the waters," those waters that he had below, which he had separated from the waters above and placed in between the expanse of the heavens, "let the waters swarm with swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the heavens." And so God created them. This is the second time that we've come across this word created. The first time is in verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. It re-emphasizes that all that is taking place here, even when it speaks of God making, God is creating. This is a powerful work of God, bringing into existence something unique, something new. In this case, he brings into existence living things. The Hebrews didn't consider the plants to be animate, living in that sense. And here we have the creation of the first living, breathing creatures. God created the great sea creatures and every living creature that moves, with which the waters swarm according to their kind, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And then we have a blessing pronounced. It's the first blessing that we find, but we will encounter others as we move through the account of the beginnings of this world. God blessed them, saying, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters in the seas, and let birds multiply on the earth." And there was evening and there was morning, the fifth day. The blessing is implicit with regard to the beasts of the earth, which he will create the following day. It's not explicitly stated with regard to them. Here it is. And the blessings in the book of Genesis are almost always associated with fertility. God blessed them and said, "Be fruitful and multiply. Fill the waters in the sea. Let the birds multiply on the earth." Indeed, we see a contrast as we work our way through the book of Genesis and indeed throughout the scriptures, that the withholding of offspring is deemed to be a curse. It shows the displeasure of God. And over and over and over again, we will encounter it both in terms of punishment, but also in terms of the effect of the fall upon this world, which has inhibited creation from fulfilling its ordained mission. God blessed them, saying, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters in the seas, and let birds multiply on the earth." On day three, God had separated the waters below the firmament so that the earth which they had covered is now revealed. God called the dry land that he caused to appear earth, and the waters were gathered together, and he called them seas. And on that third day, he also covered the earth with vegetation. And so he was the environment into which he would bring every living creature that lives upon the earth. God filled that form that he had created out of the formlessness. He filled it with livestock and creeping things and beasts. God said, "Let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds, livestock and creeping things and beasts of the earth according to their kinds." And it was so. There's an echo here of what had happened on day three. God said, "Let the earth sprout vegetation." God says here, "Let the earth bring forth living creatures." It's not that the living creatures somehow sprout up from the earth in the way the vegetation had, but it indicates something that is stated more clearly in the second chapter and verse 19. "Out of the ground the Lord God formed every beast of the field and every bird of the heavens and brought them to man to see what he would call them." So there is a similarity in that respect between the way God created man and the way he created these other earth-occupying creatures. God called upon the earth to bring forth the living creatures. But lest we misunderstand what is happening in verse 25, we are reminded it is God who made the beasts of the earth according to their kinds, the livestock according to their kinds, and everything that creeps on the ground according to its kind. What the Hebrews would have understood as the domesticated animals, the livestock, the small creatures that crawl on the ground, as well as the wild beasts, the undomesticated animals. All of this God formed, and all of this God declared was good. So here then is the world. It's very nearly finished. He has one great act of creation left to perform. We will wait until next week to explore that. But let us pause for a moment as we conclude at this point. This is the environment into which man will come as God's agent to rule and to care. An environment that has been carefully designed by God, has been systematically created by God. An environment that has been formed out of the formlessness, whose emptiness has been filled by God. It is an environment that is perfect for sustaining life. And it's an environment into which God will place man as the pinnacle of his creation in order to rule over it all. And when we look at this world, and when we consider this creation, we ought to be awed by it. Even the mention of things like 70,000 million, million, million stars as almost an offhand afterthought ought to cause us to be in absolute awe of the God who could speak these things into existence, could declare, "This is my will," and for it to be, just to be. When we look at the environment in which we live and we consider how God has so carefully ensured that everything is perfect for life, but more so that everything is perfect for man's life, a perfect environment for man to live in, a perfect world to occupy man's intellect and giftedness, we ought to be in absolute awe. What is man that you are mindful of him? But you see, the point of these opening verses of the book of Genesis is that God's thoughts were centered upon man. That when God created the heavens and the earth, formless and empty, his thoughts were on man. When God called light to shine out of the darkness, the light that would bring warmth and light to the earth and sustain life, he was thinking of man. When God called the waters to separate, to create a firmament that would surround the earth and protect it and care for it, he was thinking of man and his comfort. When God caused the waters to separate and the earth to emerge, he was thinking of man. when he caused it to sprout every green plant yielding seed and the fruit trees bearing fruit, he was thinking of man. When he set the sun in its place in the sky at daytime and the moon at night, he was thinking of man. And the birds that fly in the air and the fish that swim in the sea and the creatures that walk and crawl upon the earth, all of it was for man. So that man could live in this environment and glorify God in this environment that was made, tailor-made for him to serve God and glorify God. And living where we do, at this point in history, we ought to be absolutely awed that the God who made this world for mankind has been so patient with us. Because the God who had man in the center of his thoughts as this world was formed and filled, man gives hardly a thought to God. God hardly occupies his thoughts. And the question is, to what degree does God occupy your thoughts? You don't need to be a theologian to draw some inferences from the reality of creation. Some responsibilities that you have towards God. And that is why man is so desperate to explain away creation. If creation could ever be fully and finally disproved, God could be pronounced dead. But it cannot be, and it will not be. And the God who created this world for you demands of you full allegiance.